Growling uphill in the southbound lane of the Coast Highway, a tow truck, evidently on the way to help a stranded motorist, halted on the proverbial dime, but without a squeal of brakes. Its laboring engine fell silent from one second to the next, without a lingering chug, cough, or sputter, though its headlights still shone. Simultaneously, a Volvo about 100 feet behind the truck also stopped and fell mute. In the same instant, the breeze died. It didn't wane gradually or sputter out, but ceased as quickly as if a cosmic fan had been switched off. Thousands upon thousands of leaves stopped rustling as one. Precisely in time with the silencing of traffic and vegetation, the music from the bar cut off mid-note. Harry almost felt he had gone stone deaf. He'd never known a silence as profound in a controlled interior environment, let alone outdoors, where the life of a town and the myriad background noises of the natural world produced a ceaseless atonal symphony, even in the comparative stillness between midnight and dawn. He could not hear himself breathe, then realized that his own contribution to the preternatural hush was voluntary. He was simply so stunned by the change in the world that he was holding his breath. In addition to sound, motion had been stolen from the night. The tow truck and the Volvo were not the only things that had come to a complete standstill. The curbside trees and the shrubbery along the front of the greenhouse seemed to have been flash frozen. The leaves had not merely stopped rustling, but had entirely ceased moving. They could not have been more still if sculpted from stone. Overhanging the windows of the greenhouse, the scalloped valances on the canvas awnings had been fluttering in the breeze, but they had gone rigid in mid-flutter. Now they were as stiff as if formed from sheet metal. Across the street, the blinking arrow on a neon sign had frozen in the on position. Connie said, "Harry?" He started, as he would have at any sound except the intimate, muffled thumping of his own racing heart. He saw his own confusion and anxiety mirrored in her face. Moving to his side, she said, "What's happening?" Her voice, aside from having an uncharacteristic tremor, was vaguely different from what it had been, slightly flat in tone and marginally less inflective.
"Damned if I know," he told her.
His voice sounded much like hers, as though it issued from a mechanical device that was extremely clever but not quite perfect at reproducing the speech of any human being.
"It's gotta be him doing it," she said.
Harry agreed.
"Somehow..."
"Tick-tock?"
"Yeah."
"Shit, this is crazy."
"No argument from me."
She started to draw her revolver, then let the gun slide back into her shoulder holster. An ominous mood infused the scene, an air of fearful expectation. But for the moment, at least, there was nothing at which to shoot.
"Where is the creep?"
she wondered.
"I have a hunch he'll show up."
"No points for that one," said Connie.
Indicating the tow truck out in the street, she said,
"For God's sake, look at that."
At first, he thought Connie was just remarking on the fact that the vehicle had mysteriously halted like everything else, but then he realized what sight had pushed the needle higher on her astonishment meter. The air had been just cool enough to cause vehicle exhaust, but not their breath, to condense in pale plumes. Those thin puffs of mist hung in midair behind the tow truck, neither dispersing nor evaporating as vapor should have done. He saw another but barely visible gray-white ghost suspended behind the tailpipe of the more distant Volvo. Now that he was primed to look for them, similar wonders became evident on all sides, and he pointed them out to her. A few pieces of light debris, gum and candy wrappers, a splintered portion of popsicle stick, dry brown leaves, a tangled length of red yarn, had been swept up by the breeze. Although no draft remained to support the items, they were still aloft, as if the air had abruptly turned to purest crystal around them and had trapped them motionless for eternity. Within arm's reach, and just a foot higher than his head, two late-winter moths as white as snowflakes hung emotive, their wings soft and pearl-smooth in the glow of the street lamp. Connie tapped her wristwatch, then showed it to Harry. It was a traditional style Timex with a round dial and hands, including not only hour and minute hands, but a red second hand. It was stopped at 1:29 plus 16 seconds. Harry checked his own watch, which had a digital readout. It also showed 1:29, and the tiny blinking dot that took the place of a second hand was burning steadily, no longer counting off each 60th of a minute.
"Time has...
Connie was unable to finish the sentence. She surveyed the silent street in amazement, swallowed hard, and finally found her voice.
Time has stopped. Just stopped. Is that it?
Say what?
Time doesn't... It can't just stop.
Then what?
Physics had never been his favorite subject, and though he had some affinity for the sciences because of their ceaseless search for order in the universe, he was not as scientifically literate as he should have been in an age when science was king. However, he had retained enough of his teacher's lectures and had watched enough PBS specials and had read enough bestseller list books of popularized science to know that what Connie had said did not explain numerous aspects of what was happening to them. For one thing, if time had really stopped, why were they still conscious? How could they be aware of the phenomenon? And why weren't they frozen in that last moment of forward-moving time just as the airborne litter was, as the moths were?
No, he said shakily. It's not that simple. If time stopped, nothing would move, would it? Not even subatomic particles. And without subatomic movement, molecules of air, well, wouldn't molecules of air be as solid as molecules of iron? How would we be able to breathe?
Reacting to that thought, they both took deep and grateful breaths. The air did have a faint chemical taste, as slightly odd in its way as the timbre of their voices, but it seemed capable of sustaining life.
And light, Harry said. Light waves would stop moving. No waves to register with our eyes. So how could we see anything but darkness?
In fact, the effect of time coming to a stop probably would be infinitely more catastrophic than the stillness and silence that had descended on the world that March night. It seemed to him that time and matter were inseparable parts of creation, and if the flow of time were cut off, matter would instantly cease to exist. The universe would implode, wouldn't it? Crash back in on itself into a tiny ball of extremely dense, well, whatever the hell dense stuff it was before it had exploded to create the universe. Connie stood on her toes, reached up, and gently pinched the wing of one of the moths between thumb and forefinger. She settled back on her heels and brought the insect in front of her face for a closer inspection. Harry had not been sure if she would be able to alter the bug's position or not. He wouldn't have been surprised if the moth had hung immovably in the dead calm air, as fixed in place as a metal moth welded to a steel wall.
"Not as soft as a moth should be," she said. "Feels like it's made out of taffeta or starched fabric of some kind."
When she opened her fingers, letting go of the wing, the moth hung in the air where she had released it. Harry gently batted the bug with the back of his hand and watched with fascination as it tumbled a few inches before coming to rest in the air again. It was as motionless as it had been before they had toyed with it, just in a new position. The ways in which they affected things appeared to be pretty much normal. Their shadows moved when they did, though all the other shadows were as unmoving as the objects that cast them. They could act upon the world and pass through it as usual, but couldn't really interact with it. She had been able to move the moth, but touching it had not brought it into their reality, had not made it come alive again.
"Maybe time hasn't stopped," she said. "Maybe it just slowed way, way down for everyone and everything else except us."
"That's not it either."
"How can you be sure?"
"I can't, but I think if we're experiencing time at such a tremendously faster rate, enough faster to make the rest of the world appear to be standing still, then every move we make has incredible comparative velocity, doesn't it?"
"So?"
"I mean, a lot more velocity than any bullet fired from any gun. Velocity is destructive. If I took a bullet in my hand and threw it at you, it wouldn't do any damage. But at a few thousand feet per second, it'll punch a substantial hole in you."
She nodded, staring thoughtfully at the suspended moth.
"So if it was just a case of us experiencing time a lot faster, that swat you gave that bug would have disintegrated it."
"Yeah, I think so. I'd have probably done some damage to my hand, too."
He looked at his hand. It was unmarked.
"And if it was just that light waves are traveling slower than usual, then no lamps would be as bright as they are now. They'd be dimmer and reddish, I think, almost like infrared light."
"Maybe."
"And air molecules would be sluggish."
"Like breathing water or syrup?"
Connie asked. He nodded.
"I think so. I don't really know for sure. Hell's bells. I'm not sure even Albert Einstein would be able to figure this if he was standing right here with us.
The way this is going, he might show up any minute."
No one had gotten out of either the tow truck or the Volvo, which indicated to Harry that the occupants were as trapped in the changed world as were the moths. He could see only the shadowy forms of two people in the front seat of the more distant Volvo, but he had a better view of the man behind the wheel of the tow truck, which was almost directly across the street from them. Neither the shadows in the car nor the truck driver had moved a fraction of an inch since the stillness had fallen. Harry supposed that if they had not been on the same track as their vehicles, they might have exploded through the windshields and tumbled along the highway the instant that the tires precipitously stopped rotating. At the barroom windows of the greenhouse, six people continued to peer out in precisely the postures they had been in when the pause had come. Harry thought of it as a pause rather than a stop, because he assumed that sooner or later Tick-Tock would start things up again, assuming it was Tick-Tock who had called the halt. If not him, who else? God? Two of them were sitting at a window table, the other four were standing, two on each side of the table. Harry crossed the sidewalk and stepped between the shrubs to examine the onlookers more closely. Connie accompanied him. They stood directly in front of the glass and perhaps a foot below those inside the barroom. In addition to the gray-haired couple at the table, there was a young blonde and her 50-ish companion, one of the couples who had been sitting near the bandstand making too much noise and laughing too heartily. Now they were as quiet as the residents of any tomb. On the other side of the table stood the host and a waiter. All six were squinting through the window, leaning slightly forward toward the glass. As Harry studied them, not one blinked an eye. No face muscles twitched, not a single hair stirred. Their clothes draped them as if every garment had been carved from marble. Their unchanging expressions ranged from amusement to amazement to curiosity to, in the case of the host, perturbation. But they were not reacting to the incredible stillness that had befallen the night. Of that they were oblivious because they were a part of it. Rather, they were staring over Harry's and Connie's heads at the place on the sidewalk where the two of them had last been standing after Sammy and the dog had fled. Their facial expressions were in reaction to that interrupted bit of street theater. Connie raised one hand above her head and waved it in front of the window directly in the line of view of the onlookers. The six did not respond to it in any way whatsoever.
"They can't see us," Connie said wonderingly.
"Maybe they see us standing out there on the sidewalk in the instant that everything stopped. They could be frozen in that split second of perception and not have seen anything we've done since."
Virtually in unison, he and Connie looked over their shoulders to study the dead still street behind them, equally apprehensive of the unnatural quietude. With astonishing stealth, Tick-Tock had appeared behind them in James Ordegard's bedroom, and they had paid with pain for not anticipating him. Here he was not yet in sight, although Harry was sure that he was coming. Returning her attention to the gathering inside the bar, Connie rapped her knuckles against a pane of glass. The sound was slightly tinny, differing from the right sound of knuckles against glass to the same small but audible degree that their current voices differed from their real ones. The onlookers did not react. To Harry, they seemed to be more securely imprisoned than the most isolated man in the deepest cell in the world's worst police state. Like flies in amber, they were trapped in one meaningless moment of their lives. There was something horribly vulnerable about their helpless suspension and their blissful ignorance of it. Their plight, although they were almost certainly unaware of it, sent a chill along Harry's spine. He rubbed the back of his neck to warm it.
"If they still see us out on the sidewalk," Connie said, "what happens if we go away from here and then everything starts up again?"
Harry answered, "I suppose to them it'll appear as if we vanished into thin air right before their eyes."
"My God!"
"It'll give them a jolt, all right." She turned away from the window, faced him. Worry lines creased her brow. Her dark eyes were haunted, and her voice was somber to an extent not fully attributable to the change in its tone and pitch.
"Harry, this bastard isn't just some spoon-bending, fortune-telling, sleight-of-hand Vegas lounge act."
"We already knew he had real power."
"Power?"
"Yes."
"Harry, this is more than power. The word just doesn't convey, you hear me?"
"I hear you," he said placatingly.
"Just by willing it, he can stop time, stop the engine of the world, jam the gears, do whatever the fuck it is he's done. That's more than power. That's being God. What chance do we have against someone like that?"
"We have a chance."
"What chance? How?" We have a chance,
he insisted stubbornly.
Yeah? Well, I think this guy can squash us like bugs anytime he wants, and he's just been stalling because he enjoys watching bugs suffer.
You don't sound like the Connie Gulliver I know, Harry said more sharply than he had intended.
Well, maybe I'm not.
She put one thumb to her mouth and used her teeth to trim off a full crescent of the nail. He had never seen her bite her nails before, and he was almost as astonished by that revelation of nervousness as he would be if she had broken down and cried. She said,
Maybe I tried to ride a wave too big for me, got dumped bad, lost my nerve.
It was inconceivable to Harry that Connie Gulliver could lose her nerve over anything at all, not even over something as strange and frightening as what was happening to them. How could she lose her nerve when she was all nerve, 115 pounds or so of solid nerve? She turned away from him, swept the street with her gaze again, walked to some azalea bushes and parted them with one hand, revealing the hiding dog.
These don't feel quite like leaves. Stiffer. More like thin cardboard.
He joined her, stooped, and petted the dog, which was as frozen by the paws as were the bar patrons.
His fur feels like fine wire.
I think he was trying to tell us something.
So do I, now.
Because he sure knew something was about to happen when he hid in these bushes. Harry remembered the thought he'd had in the men's room of the greenhouse. The only indication that I haven't become imprisoned in a fairy tale is the absence of a talking animal. Funny how hard it was to break a man's grasp on his sanity. After 100 years of Freudian analysis, people were conditioned to believe that sanity was a fragile possession, that everyone was a potential victim of neuroses or psychoses caused by abuse, neglect, or even by the ordinary stresses of daily life. If he had seen the events of the past 13 hours as the plot of a movie, he'd have found it unbelievable, smugly certain that the male lead, himself, would have cracked from the strain of so many supernatural events and encounters combined with so much physical abuse. Yet here he was, with aches in most of his muscles and pains in half his joints, but with his wits intact. Then he realized that perhaps he could not assume his wits were intact. Unlikely as it was, he might be already strapped down on a bed in a psychiatric ward with a rubber wedge in his mouth to keep him from biting off his tongue in a mad frenzy. The silent and unmoving world might be only a delusion. Sweet thought. When Connie let go of the azalea branches that she had moved, they did not fall back into place. Harry had to press gently on them to force them to drape the dog once more. They rose to their feet and scrutinized the visible length of Pacific Coast Highway, the shoulder-to-shoulder businesses on both sides, the narrow, dark gaps between the buildings. The world was a huge clockwork mechanism with a bent key, broken springs, and rust-locked gears. Harry tried to tell himself that he was growing accustomed to this weird state of affairs, but he was not convincing. If he'd gotten so mellow about it, why was there a cold sweat on his brow, under his arms, and down the small of his back? The totally becalmed night exerted no tranquilizing influence, for there was spring-taut violence and sudden death under its peaceful facade. Instead, it was deeply eerie and growing more so with the passage of each non-second. Enchantment, Harry said.
What?
Like in a fairy tale, the whole world has fallen under an evil enchantment, a spell.
So where the hell is the witch who did it? That's what I want to know.
Not witch. Harry corrected. That's female. A male witch is a warlock or sorcerer. She was fuming.
Whatever. Damn it, where is he? Why is he toying with us like this, taking so long to show his face?
Glancing at his wristwatch, Harry confirmed that the red second indicator had not resumed blinking and that the time on the readout was still at 1:29.
Actually, how much time he's taking depends on how you look at it. I guess you could say that he hasn't taken any time at all.
She noted the 1:29 on her watch.
Come on, come on, let's get this over with. Or do you think he's waiting for us to go looking for him?
Elsewhere in the night, there arose the first sound since the pause that they had not made themselves. Laughter. The low, gravelly laughter of the golem vagrant who had burned like a tallow candle in Harry's condo and later reappeared to hammer on them in Ordegard's house. Again, out of habit, they reached for their revolvers. Then both remembered the uselessness of guns against this adversary and left their weapons holstered. South of them, at the uphill end of the block, on the other side of the street, tick-tock turned the corner,
wearing his all-too-familiar vagrant identity. If anything, the golem seemed bigger than before, well over 7 feet tall instead of 6.5, with a greater tangle of hair and wildness of beard than when they'd seen him last. Leonine head, tree-trunk neck, massive shoulders, impossibly broad chest, hands as big as tennis rackets. His black raincoat was as voluminous as a tent.
Why the hell was I so impatient for him?
Connie wondered, voicing Harry's identical thought. His troll-mean laughter fading, Tick-Tock stepped off the far curb and started to cross the street diagonally, coming straight toward them.
What's the plan?
Connie asked.
What plan? There's always a plan, damn it.
Indeed, Harry was surprised to realize that they had stood waiting for the golem without giving a thought to a course of action. They had been cops for so many years and had worked as partners long enough that they knew how best to respond in every situation to virtually any threat. Usually, they didn't actually have to put their heads together on a strategy. They just acted instinctively, each of them confident that the other would make all the right moves as well. On the rare occasions when they needed to talk out a plan of action, a few one-word sentences sufficed, the short speak of partners in sync. However, confronted by a nearly invulnerable adversary made of bloodless mud and stones and worms and God knew what else, by a fierce and relentless fighter who was but one of an endless army that their real enemy could create, they seemed bereft of both instinct and brains, able only to stand paralyzed and watch him approach. Run, Harry thought, and was about to take his own advice when the towering golem stopped in the middle of the street, about 50 feet away. The golem's eyes were different from anything Harry had seen before, not just luminous, but blazing, blue. The hot blue of gas flames, dancing brightly in his sockets. His eyes cast images of flickering blue fire on his cheekbones and made the frizzy ends of his beard look like thin filaments of blue neon. Tick-Tock spread his arms and raised his enormous hands above his head in the manner of an Old Testament prophet standing on a mountain and addressing his followers below, relaying messages from beyond. Tablets of stone containing 100 commandments could have been concealed within his generous raincoat.
In 1 hour of real time, the world starts up again,
Tick-Tock said.
I'll count to 50. A head start. Survive 1 hour and I'll let you live. Never torment you again.
Dear sweet Jesus, Connie whispered. He really is a child playing nasty games.
That made him at least as dangerous as any other sociopath. More so. Some young children, in their innocence of empathy, had the capacity to be extremely cruel. Tick-Tock said,
I'll hunt you down fair and square. Use none of my tricks, just my eyes.
And he pointed to his blazing blue sockets.
My ears.
And he pointed to one of those.
And my wits.
He tapped the side of his skull with one thick forefinger.
No tricks, no special powers. More fun that way. 1, 2, better run, don't you think? 3, 4, 5.
This can't be happening,
Connie said, but she turned and ran anyway. Harry followed her. They sprinted to the alley and around the side of the greenhouse, almost colliding with the bony hobo who had called himself Sammy and who was now frozen precariously on 1 foot in mid-stride. Their feet made curious, hollow, slapping sounds on the blacktop as they exploded past Sammy and raced deeper into the dark back street, almost the sound of running footsteps, but not quite. The echoes, too, were not precisely like echoes in the real world, less reverberant and too short-lived. As he ran, wincing at 100 separate pains that flared with each footfall, Harry struggled to devise some strategy by which they might survive the hour. But, like Alice, they had crossed through the looking glass into the kingdom of the Red Queen, and no plans or logic would work in that land of the Mad Hatter and Cheshire Cat, where reason was despised and chaos embraced.
Eleven. 12. You're dead if I find you. 13.
Brian was having so much fun. He sprawled naked on the black silk sheets, busily creating and gloriously becoming, while the votive eyes adored him from their glass reliquaries. Yet a part of him was in the golem, which was also exhilarating. He had constructed the creature bigger this time, made it a fierce and unstoppable killing machine, the better to terrorize the big-shot hero and his bitch. Its immense shoulders were his shoulders, too, and its powerful arms were his to use. Curling those arms, feeling the inhuman muscles flex and contract and flex, was so thrilling that he could barely contain his excitement over the hunt before him.
16, 17, 18.
He had made this giant from dirt and clay and sand, given its body the appearance of flesh, and animated it, just as the first god had created Adam from lifeless mud. Although his destiny was to be a more merciless divinity than any who had come before him, he could create as well as destroy. No one could say that he was less a god than others who had ruled. No one. No one. Standing in the middle of Pacific Coast Highway, towering there, he gazed out upon the still and silent world and was pleased with what he had wrought. This was his greatest and most secret power, the ability to stop everything as easily as a watchmaker could stop a ticking timepiece merely by opening the casing and applying the proper tool to the key point in the mechanism.
24. 25.
This power had arisen within him during one of his psychic growth surges when he was 16, though he had been 18 before he had learned to use it well. That was to be expected. Jesus, too, had needed time to learn how to turn water into wine, how to multiply a few loaves and fishes to feed multitudes. Will. The power of will. That was the proper tool with which to remake reality. Before the beginning of time and the birth of this universe, there had been one will that had brought it all into existence, a consciousness that people called God, though God was no doubt utterly different from all the ways that humankind had pictured him. Perhaps only a child at play who, as a game, created galaxies like grains of sand. If the universe was a perpetual motion machine created as an act of will, it could also be altered by sheer will, remade or destroyed. All that was needed to manipulate and edit the first god's creation was power and understanding. Both had been given to Brian. The power of the atom was a dim light when compared to the blindingly brilliant power of the mind. By applying his will, by intently focusing thought and desire, he found that he could make fundamental changes in the very foundation of existence.
31, 32, 33.
Because he was still earnestly becoming and was not yet the new god, Brian was able to sustain these changes only for short periods, usually no more than 1 hour of real time. Occasionally, he grew impatient with his limits, but he was certain the day would arrive when he could alter current reality in ways that would be permanent, if he so wished. In the meantime, as he continued to become, he satisfied himself with amusing alterations that temporarily negated all the laws of physics and, at least for a short while, tailored reality to his desire. Although it would appear to Lyon and Gulliver that time had ground to a halt, the truth was more complicated than that. By the application of his extraordinary will, almost like wishing before blowing out the candles on a birthday cake, he had reconceived the nature of time. If it had been an ever-flowing river of dependable effect, he had transformed it into a series of streams, large placid lakes, and geysers with a variety of effects. This world now lay in one of the lakes where time advanced at such an excruciatingly slow rate that it appeared to have stopped flowing. Yet, also at his wish, he and the two cops interacted with this new reality much as they had with the old, experiencing only minor changes in most of the laws of matter, energy, motion, and force.
40. 41.
As if making a birthday wish, as if wishing on a star, as if wishing to a fairy godmother, wishing, wishing, wishing with all his considerable might, he had created the perfect playground for a spirited game of hide-and-seek. And so what if he had bent the universe to make a toy of it?
He was aware that he was two people of widely disparate natures. On the one hand, he was a god becoming, exalted with incalculable authority and responsibility. On the other hand, he was a reckless and selfish child, cruel and prideful. In that respect, he fancied that he was like humankind itself, only more so.
45.
In fact, he believed he had been anointed precisely because of the kind of child he had been. Selfishness and pride were merely reflections of ego, and without a strong ego, no man could have the confidence to create. A certain amount of recklessness was required if one hoped to explore the limits of one's creative powers. Taking chances without regard for consequences could be liberating and a virtue. And as he was to be the god who would chasten humankind for its pollution of the earth, cruelty was a requirement of becoming. His ability to remain a child, to avoid spending his creative energy in the senseless breeding of more animals for the herd, made him the perfect candidate for divinity.
49. 50.
For a while, he would keep his promise to hunt them down only with the aid of ordinary human senses. It would be fun, challenging, and it would be good to experience the severe limitations of their existence, not in order to develop compassion for them. They did not deserve compassion, but to more fully enjoy, by comparison, his own extraordinary powers. In the body of the hulking vagrant, Brian moved from the street into the fabulous amusement park that was the dead-still, whisperless town.
"Here I come," he shouted. "Ready or not."
A dangling pine cone, like a Christmas ornament suspended by a thread from the bough above, had been arrested in mid-drop by the paws. An orange and white cat had been stilled while leaping from a tree branch to the top of a stucco wall, airborne, forepaws reaching, back legs sprung out behind. A rigid, unchanging filigree of smoke curled from a fireplace chimney. As she and Harry ran farther into the strange, unbeating heart of the paralyzed town, Connie did not believe that they would escape with their lives. Nonetheless, she frantically conceived and discarded numerous strategies to elude Tick-Tock for 1 hour. Under the hard shell of cynicism that she had nurtured so lovingly for so long, like every poor fool in the world, she evidently treasured the hope that she was different and would live forever. She should have been embarrassed to find within herself such a stupid animal faith in her own immortality. Instead, she embraced it. Hope could be a treacherous kind of confidence, but she couldn't see how their predicament could be made worse by a little positive thinking. In one night, she had learned so many new things about herself. It would be a pity not to live long enough to build a better life on those discoveries. For all of her fevered thinking, only pathetic strategies occurred to her. Without slowing, between increasingly ragged gasps for breath, she suggested they change streets often, turning this way and that in the feeble hope that a twisting trail would somehow be harder to follow than one that was arrow straight. And she guided them along a downhill route where possible because they could cover more ground in less time if they weren't fighting a rising grade. Around them, the inert residents of Laguna Beach were oblivious to the fact that they were running for their lives, and if she and Harry were caught, no screams would wake these enchanted sleepers or bring help. She knew why Ricky Estefan's neighbors had not heard the golem exploding up through his hallway floor and beating him to death. Tick-Tock had stopped time in every corner of the world except inside that bungalow. Ricky's torture and murder had been conducted with sadistic leisure, while no time at all was passing for the rest of humanity. Likewise, when Tick-Tock had accosted them in Ortegaard's house and had thrown Connie through the glass sliding door into the master bedroom balcony, neighbors had not responded to the crash or to the gunshots that had preceded it because the entire confrontation had taken place in non-time, in a dimension one step removed from reality. As she ran at her top speed, she counted to herself, trying to maintain the slow rhythm in which Tick-Tock had been counting. She reached 50 much too soon and doubted they had put half enough ground between them and him to be safe. If she had continued counting, she might have reached 100 before finally they had to stop. They leaned against a brick wall to catch their breath. Her chest was tight and her heart seemed to have swelled to the point of bursting. Each breath felt searingly hot. as if she were a fire-eater in a circus exhaling ignited gasoline fumes. Her throat was raw. Calf and thigh muscles ached, and the increased circulation renewed all the pain and all of the bumps and bruises she'd gotten during the night. Harry looked worse than she felt. Of course, he had received more blows and more encounters with Tick-Tock than she had sustained, and had been on the run longer. When she could speak, she said, "Now what?" At first, each word puffed from him explosively. "What about using grenades?"
"Grenades?
Like Ordegard."
Yeah, I remember.
"Bullets don't work on a golem," she said.
"I noticed.
But if we blew the damn thing to pieces, where are we going to find grenades, huh? You know, a friendly neighborhood explosive shop around here? Maybe a National Guard armory, someplace like that."
"Get real, Harry."
"Why? The rest of the world isn't.
We blow one of those damn things to smithereens, he just scoops up some mud and makes another.
But it'll slow him down. Maybe 2 minutes. "Every minute counts," he said. "We've just got to get through 1 hour." She looked at him with disbelief.
"Are you saying you think he'll keep his promise?"
With his coat sleeve, Harry wiped sweat off his face.
"Well, he might." "Like hell."
"He might," Harry insisted. She was ashamed of herself for wanting to believe. She listened to the night. Nothing. That didn't mean Tick-Tock wasn't nearby.
"We've got to get going,"
she said.
"Where?"
No longer needing to lean against the wall for support, Connie looked around and discovered they were in the parking lot beside a bank. 80 feet away, a car was stopped near the 24-hour automatic teller. 2 men stood at the machine in the bluish glow from an overhead security lamp. Something about the postures of the two was wrong. Not just that they were as still as statues, something else. Connie started across the parking lot toward the odd tableau.
"Where are you going?" Harry asked. "Check this out."
Her instinct proved reliable. The pause had hit in the middle of a robbery. The first man was using his bank card to get $300 from the machine. He was in his late 50s with white hair, a white mustache, and a kind face now lined with fear. The packet of crisp bills had begun to slide out of the dispenser and into his hand when everything had stopped. The perp was in his late teens or early 20s, blonde, good-looking. In Nikes, jeans, and a sweatshirt now, he was one of those Beach Boy types who could be found all summer long on every street of downtown Laguna, wearing sandals and cutoffs, flat-bellied with a mahogany tan, white-haired from the sun. To look at him as he was at that moment, or as he would be when summer came, you might suspect that he lacked ambition and had a talent for leisure, but you would not imagine that anyone so wholesome in appearance could harbor criminal intentions. Even in the act of robbery, he appeared to be cherubic and had a pleasant smile. He was holding a .32-caliber pistol in his right hand, the muzzle jammed against the older man's spine. Connie moved around the pair, studying them thoughtfully.
"What are you doing?" Harry asked. "We've got to deal with this.
We don't have time."
"We're cops, aren't we?"
Harry said. "We're being hunted, for God's sake.
Who else is going to keep the world from going to hell in a handbasket if we don't?"
Wait a minute, he said. "I thought you were in this line of work for the thrill and to prove something to yourself. Isn't that what you said earlier?
And aren't you in it to preserve order, protect the innocent?"
Harry took a deep breath as if to argue, then let it out in an explosive sigh of exasperation. It wasn't the first time during the past 6 months that she had elicited that reaction from him. She thought he was sort of cute when he was exasperated. It was such a pleasing change from his usual equanimity, which got boring because it was so constant. In fact, Connie even liked the way he looked tonight, rumpled and in need of a shave. She had never seen him this way, had never expected to see him this way, and thought he seemed more rough than seedy, more dangerous than she would have believed he could look.
Okay,
he said, stepping into the robbery tableau to inspect the perp and victim more closely. "What do you want to do?"
"Make a few adjustments."
"Might be dangerous."
"That velocity business? Well, the moth didn't disintegrate."
Cautiously, she touched one finger to the perp's face. His skin felt leathery and his flesh was somewhat firmer than it should have been. When she took her finger away, she left a shallow dimple in his cheek, which evidently would not disappear until the pause ended. Staring into his eyes, she said,
"Creep."
In no way whatsoever did he acknowledge her presence. She was invisible to him. When time resumed its usual flow, he would not be aware that she had ever been there.
She pulled back on the perp's gun arm. It moved, but with stiff resistance. Connie was patient because she worried that time might be able to move forward again when she least expected it, and her presence might startle the reanimated gunman, and that he might accidentally pull the trigger. Conceivably, she could cause him to blow the older man away, although his original intention might have been only to commit a robbery. When the muzzle of the .32 was no longer pressed against the victim's spine, Connie slowly pushed it to the left until it was not pointed at him at all, but aimed harmlessly into the night. Harry carefully pried the gunman's fingers off the pistol. It's like we're kids playing with life-size action figures. The .32 stayed precisely where it had been when the perp's hand had encircled it, suspended in midair. Connie found that the gun could be moved more easily than the gunman, although it still offered some resistance. She took it to the man at the automatic teller, pressed it into his right hand, and closed his fingers tightly around it. When the pause ended, he would find a pistol in his hand where none had been a fraction of a second previously, and would have no idea how it had gotten there. From the payout tray of the machine, she removed the banded packet of 20s and put it in the customer's left hand. "I see how the $10 bill ended up magically back in my hand after I gave it to that hobo," she said. Surveying the night uneasily, Harry said, "And how the 4 bullets I pumped into him ended up in my shirt pocket." "The head of that religious statue in my hand from Ricky Estefan's shrine," she frowned. "Give you the creepy crawlies to think we were like these people, frozen in time, and the bastard played with us that way."
"You done here?"
"Not quite. Come on, help me turn the guy away from the machine."
Together, they rocked him around 180 degrees as if he were a garden statue carved from marble. When they were finished, the victim not only had the pistol but was covering the perp with it. Like set dressers in a wax museum handling extremely realistic mannequins, they had redesigned the scene and given it a new kind of drama.
"Okay, now let's get out of here," Harry said, and started to move away from the bank across the parking lot. Connie hesitated, examining their handiwork. He looked back, saw she wasn't following him, and turned to her.
"Now what?"
Shaking her head, she said,
"This is too dangerous. The good guy has the gun now."
"Yes, but he'll be surprised when he finds it in his hand. He might drop it. The creep here might get a hold of it again, probably will, and then they'll be right back where we found them."
Harry returned, an apoplectic look on his face.
"Have you forgotten a certain dirty, demented, scar-faced gentleman in a black raincoat?"
"I don't hear him yet."
"Connie, for God's sake, he could stop time for us, too, then take however damn long he wants to walk up to us, wait until he was right in front of us before letting us back into the game. So you wouldn't hear him until he tore your nose off and asked you if you'd like a handkerchief."
"If he's going to cheat like that..."
"Cheat? Why wouldn't he cheat?"
Harry demanded exasperatedly, although 2 minutes ago he had been arguing that there was a chance Tick-Tock might keep his promise and play fair.
"We aren't talking about Mother Teresa here."
"Then it doesn't matter whether we finish our work or run. Either way, he'll get us."
The keys to the white-haired bank patron's car were in the ignition. Connie took them out and unlocked the trunk. The lid did not pop up. She had to lift it as if she were raising the lid on a coffin.
"This is anal retentive," Harry told her.
"Oh, like you might ordinarily be expected to handle it, huh?"
He blinked at her. Harry took the perp under the arms, and Connie grabbed him by the feet. They carried him to the back of the car and gently lowered him into the trunk. The body seemed somewhat heavier than it would have been in real time. Connie tried to slam the lid, but in this altered reality, her push didn't give it the momentum to go all the way down. She had to lean on it to make the latch click into place. When the pause ended and time started up again, the perpetrator would find himself in the trunk of the car with no memory whatsoever of how he had wound up in that unhappy position. In the blink of an eye, he would have gone from being assailant to prisoner. Harry said, "I think I understand how I wound up 3 times in the same chair in Ortegaard's kitchen with the barrel of my own gun in my mouth."
"He kept taking you out of real time and putting you there."
"Yeah, a child playing pranks." Connie wondered if that was also how the snakes and tarantulas had gotten into Ricky Estefan's kitchen. During a previous pause, had Tick-Tock gathered them from pet shops, laboratories, or even from their nests in the wild, and then put them in the bungalow? Had he started time up again, at least for Ricky, startling the poor man with the sudden infestation? Connie walked away from the car into the parking lot, where she stopped and listened to the unnatural night. It was as if everything in the world had suddenly died, from the wind to all of humanity, leaving a planet-wide cemetery where grass and flowers and trees and mourners were made of the same granite as the tombstones. At times in recent years, she has considered chucking police work and moving to some cheap shack on the edge of the Mojave, as far away from people as she could get. She lived so spartanly that she had substantial savings. Living as a desert rat, she could make the money last a long time. The barren, peopleless expanses of sand and scrub and rock were immensely appealing when compared to modern civilization. But the pause was far different from the peace of a sun-baked desert landscape where life was still a part of the natural order, and where civilization, sick as it was, still existed somewhere over the horizon. After only about 10 non-minutes of silence and stillness as deep as death, Connie longed for the flamboyant folly of the human circus. The species was too fond of lying, cheating, envy, ignorance, self-pity, self-righteousness, and utopian visions that always led to mass murder. But until and if it destroyed itself, it harbored the potential to become nobler, to take responsibility for its actions, to live and let live, and to earn the stewardship of Earth. Hope. For the first time in her life, Connie Gulliver had begun to believe that hope, in itself, was a reason to live and to tolerate civilization as it was. But Tick-Tock, as long as he lived, was the end of hope.
"I hate this son of a bitch like I've never hated anyone," she said. "I want to get him. I want to waste him so bad I can hardly stand it."
"To get him, first we have to stay alive," Harry reminded her.
"Let's go."